Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
I'm HRN's Communication Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're exploring the future of eating animals, and we're going beyond typical meat sources.
If you look at the length of human history, we've been eating insects a lot longer than we haven't been in the United States and Western Europe.
We're looking at unusual ways to purchase meat.
People are like, really? Why would I want to buy that out of a machine?
And we introduce you to Frank Reese, a poultry farmer whose traditional farming methods are featured in a new documentary.
I'm a fourth generation farmer in Kansas, and I focus basically all on standard bred poultry and have my whole life.
He's kind of the last one standing with these rarefied breeds that are so important for if we're going to eat chicken and turkey into the future. He's essential. He's a national treasure.
Listen to Meat and Three this week to better understand the history and the future of meat. Available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I tell you, Pete, murder.
It is murder.
And it's going to be a killer show today. I can't believe it. We're going to be talking about archaeobiology.
What?
That's right. We're going to be talking about wine, poetry, songs, and maybe even
speaking
pizza.
English. Come
We're
on.
We're going back. How far back are we going?
How
way
far back are you going?
Way back. We're going to ask the musical and magical question, what did Jesus drink? It's Mike Edison.
What did he turn water into wine?
And that's everybody's favorite pizza, Pizzaremba.
I'm here.
You're there.
Barely. More dead than alive, but I made it. I wouldn't miss this show for all the wine in Canaan.
Which came in earthenware.
And forests.
Well, what was the legal drinking age in 2000?
In
2000 BC. In 33 AD.
All I know is that you were running around like a maniac trying to find one of those amphora openers.
Anyway, we're joined by Kevin Bigos today, who is the author, science journalist, and author of Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. And I got to tell you, I'm loving this book.
This sleepy
Kevin,
audience.
Good to see you.
Hey, Mike, great to be on.
So we've got a wine scientist with a punk rock
past.
Can
you hold the book up for the audience?
You can't beat that. Do the George Thorogood, we call that. Because once I was on the radio with George Thorogood, and they said, so you have a new record, and you actually held it up.
Hold it up.
That's what happens when you do 8,000 like bar gigs in a row. you get a little punchy like that.
The cover's beautiful.
Let's show it to the audience.
They did a great job. Who's responsible for this?
This guy.
They did a great job.
Professional.
See, look at this little strand of DNA, which right there on the cover, because the book is...
I insisted on that.
All right.
DNA on the cover.
Well, the only wine book with DNA on the cover. So tell us, Kevin, about your book and the DNA of wine.
came about completely by accident, like most good things in life. I was in Amman, Jordan, not where you think to find wine, and my little hotel minibar had a bottle from Cremason Monastery and Winery in Bethlehem. And that was 10 years ago, 2008, and I thought to myself, monks are making wine in the Middle East in 2008? So I tried it.
Maybe not in 2009.
Well, were they making it? There's a map in the book and sort of says the spread of wine, and it starts in 8,000 BC, likely origin of wine.
Caucasus Mountains.
So bring us back 8,000, I guess that would be 10,000 years now. Did I do the math right?
Yep. Armenia, Republic of Georgia, Eastern Turkey, somebody was collecting bunches of grapes in the barrels, and they let them sit for too long, so the natural yeast fermented, turned it into wine. And they took a sip, and they were like, whoa, this is something different.
That was their peanut butter and the chocolate moment. They left the wine for too long.
But not only that, they started to figure out
the grapes for too long.
Most grapes are male and female. You know, they have to pollinate and do all that. There's a little segment of wine grapes that are hermaphroditic, self-pollinating. So humans started select all the wine grapes in the world now. Every vineyard, France, Italy, California, is descendants of those early hermaphroditic wine grapes that humans picked out, because every year they
very ahead of the curve.
Yep. Well, we're a very progressive show and perfect for Pride Week.
Yep.
That's right. We don't judge boy wine, girl wine.
The whole wine industry is based on hermaphroditic grapes.
Gender fluid wine. So let's get right to it. I see a couple of bottles of wine sitting here on the table.
There are.
Kevin.
What are these?
So while you're pouring this, answer the question that everyone wants to know, and that is, what did they serve at the Last Supper? And did it pair well with the lamb?
Well, believe it or not, that wine I tried in Amman, Jordan, made by Cremason Monasteries, they use these strange grapes with names like Hamdani and Jaladi and Baladi. Dabuki, obviously, long way from Merlot and all that. It turns out those grapes really were probably growing there 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. They've done DNA analysis, whole family tree. They were there way before Merlot. So the answer is the Last Supper could have had Jandali wine.
I looked up, and I found this on an oddly Christian site that said that all the wine drinking in the Bible was not an excuse for Christians to drink excessively. That was sort of the message
I think they're way off message, because when they ran out of wine at the wedding of Cana, Christ chose that to be his first miracle, to keep the wine coming.
John 2, yep. Change the water into wine.
Exactly.
And the whole Bible's filled with, you know, the grapes of wrath. That's from the Bible, the Steinbeck title.
So, but it was wine, right? It was wine as we would know it. Yeah. We would recognize this as wine.
Well, again, holding this up for the audience, we just poured a supposedly white wine, but it's actually very orangish, unfiltered. So the old wine, they didn't add anything to it. It was like unfiltered apple cider. You know how cloudy it is and sort of wild and rambunctious. So the old wine would have been more like that. They only started filtering the last 50, 100
years. Well, this looks like a trendy orange wine.
It does. It smells like an oxidized, the floor.
This is 5 years in oak barrel, a native Greek wine from a local grape, but after they ferment it naturally, they put it for 5 years in oak barrels. So, whole kind of different.
It's got almost tastes like sherry.
Yes, like the
high-end grape there from Jerez, those wines from the south of Spain.
Salty, too. Yep, a little bit of salting.
Fascinating.
The whole profile we have of just a pleasing, normal kind of white Chardonnay was much wilder thousands of years ago. They had much more variety of wild yeast, wild grapes, all these intermixes.
So was the East Village was wild 1,000 years ago. Everything was wild 1,000 years ago.
This appears in the glass like a sherry, a tawny. Would you say tawny?
Yep.
Very tawny. And it tastes like, in France you'd have the Chateau Chalon, which is produced, it's somewhat like this, or Jerez.
With skins, right. And skins.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, you would expect the path of the grapes to go that way through southern Spain, and I expect the Romans had something to do with all of this.
They came along much later. They got there about 5,000 years after the Caucasus Mountains, but then they finally brought it to France, and the French finally learned and mastered it and got better than everybody else. But
the Romans did like to tipple. I saw Caligula. I know this for a fact. The documentary Caligula.
Oh, they made big money off importing, exporting, controlling all the trade routes, the wine trade routes.
And where is Rome? In Italy?
The audience was supposed to applause at that, I think. I'm trying to figure that one out.
This Christian website I stumbled on said, certainly did not say that Jesus drank Manischewitz, which I was very disappointed to find out.
Shapiro.
Because apparently my family's been doing it wrong for years, but said that what he drank was similar to an Amarone.
Yeah, you know, people used to say that before they did the DNA analysis on these local grapes of the Middle East. That's just the last few years they started actually, you know, using DNA to figure out what the heritage was. So, Amarone, that's probably just a wild guess.
I want to know more about this DNA because Kevin is a scientist, okay? He's not like you and I, civilians. A science journalist, okay? Okay. he's not your rank and file dipsomaniac like we are. The man knows of what he talks.
Well, at least now. 10 years ago, I didn't. And then I figured out, hey, they're starting to use DNA to analyze wine grapes just like we analyze our own genome. That blew me away. And using mass spectrometry and all sorts of things to analyze little tiny remains on Egyptian tombs to figure out what spices they used. So all those high-tech medical tools are starting to, you know, document wine down to the molecule, you know, exactly now, what molecule gives it.
Were the Egyptians into drinking wine, or were they more beer?
Huge into drinking wine.
Did you see that? Everyone always, you know.
You know, they were doing serious winemaking like 5,000 years ago. They named the vintage on the amphora, they named the winemaker, they named the vineyard, and the quality of wine. And sometimes they had 10 or 12 stamps for the tax and exports to keep track of, like...
Mm-hmm. Render and under they would Caesar. Seal it. What is Caesar's? That's what I'm talking about.
Render under Caesar. Exactly.
And, you know, they had all these complicated seals to supposedly keep it, you know, fresh. But it was big business. They planted big vineyards all through the southern Nile floodplains.
And what about the Sumerians? I mean, with all of
They were the first, probably, to really large scale. You know, the Hittites and the Sumerians, Babylon, all those cities, they actually had a sort of steward of the army called the Galgestin, who was like the wine steward for the army, because it sounds like if you didn't give your army enough wine, they kind of got a little rowdy, and you know, you had to really keep the army happy or you were in trouble.
Wine later they upped that to whiskey by the time of the American Civil War.
Well, this is fascinating again. The wine that we're drinking, and what is it again?
Where is it from, very specifically?
Yeah. This is from Greece, from the Attica area, and they call it Old Barrel. It's a Sabbatiano native grape, which is just grown in that one area. But then they ferment it with wild yeast, but then leave it in barrels for another 5 years. So it's pretty unusual.
Totally unusual.
And I don't know, that's what I thought Mike wanted, you know.
He didn't
want me to bring him like a California Chardonnay.
No.
Wow.
I certainly didn't. This is great. It does, to me, taste like a little bit sweet. It's got a little sweet and salty. But it's not light. But it tastes like sherry. It tastes like something that would be very good with tapas before the bullfight.
And I brought this because there's even records thousands of years ago of 3-year-old wine and 5-year-old wine and 10 or 20-year-old wine. So they figured out somehow how to keep it, you know, in these amphoras sealed with probably plaster and reeds and all sorts of things. So old wine, you know, has been a thing for thousands of years.
Haven't they recovered wine in amphoras from shipwrecks?
They have. Usually it's not wine anymore, but now they can analyze even just the stains on the old amphora. You know, it used to just be a stain. You didn't know what it was. Right.
So, yeah, wine stains are pretty hard to get out, so I guess...
Exactly.
You find you have that problem?
Housewives 5,000 years ago, you know, they're like...
I tell you, when I moved to Spain, and I lived in Madrid, and the first night I went out, we were going to this art gallery, and I was meeting some new people, and they said you should wear black, and I got very uppity. I got very like, but I got my East Village punk rock snoot on. I said, "Well, wear black because you don't think I'm cool enough. I should wear black." And they're like, "No, you retard, because everybody's going to be drinking red wine. It's going to be a crowded art gallery, and someone's going to spill it on you because it's Spain. And if you're wearing anything but black, it'll show." Oh, duh. I got told. Anyway, speaking of records...
You'll never know how much I really love you.
You'll never know how much I really care. Yeah. All right, I think it's time.
I think there's a song in your heart.
There's
Mike.
A song
That's
in my heart.
You.
There's wine in my glass.
We're talking
to Kevin Bigos, and his new book is Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. And I think this calls for Styx McGee and Wine Spodiote.
Whoa, okay.
Well, damn New Orleans, where everything's fine.
wine. Drinking that garbage, drinking that wine. Drinking that mess with the light. When they get drunk, they fight all night. Drink wine, studio, drink wine.
Wine, wine.
Wine, studio, drink
wine. Wine, wine.
In the studio, baby, pass that bottle to me. Well, I got a nickel, baby, you got a dime. Let's get together and buy a little wine. Some by the fifth and some by the fourth. When you buy and share, then you're doing things smart. Drinking wine, Spodio, drinking wine.
Wine, wine.
Wine, Spodio, drinking wine.
Wine, wine.
Drinking wine, Spodio, baby, pass that bottle to me. All right, dude. With the light anywhere, they get drunk, they fight all night. Yeah, they're knocking down windows and they're knocking down doors. Drink a half a gallon, then we'll holler for more. Drink wine, Spodio, drink wine, wine, wine. Wine, Spodio, drink wine,
wine.
Wine, Spodio, to beat, pass that bottle to me. Go ahead, take one more. Can you dig it?
I'm drinking some wine now.
Arts and Cedars.
It's attic wine. Not from the attic, baby. From Attica.
All right.
Ah, oh, the people. The people.
Oh.
The people.
Finally. Finally. Finally, Matt's found the applause button. Matt, you got another button. We have a great audio clip. I love the part in your book, Kevin, with one of my heroes, the great Richard Feynman, the physicist, talks about wine. He's given a lecture about wine. And there's a lot of poetry in this book, too, by the way.
Larry's brother.
People love songs about wine. They love poetry.
There's a whole genre of wine poets. There were Muslim wine poets. So even though it was banned, they couldn't resist.
Take your poetries about it. Couldn't drink it. But
no, they drank
no,
it.
No, of course.
They,
when your heart is cradled in sorrow and trouble today and tomorrow, day after day, drink the liquid of the grape, my friend. That was Israel Ben Moses Najara. That was late. That was like late 15th century.
Yep, in Gaza.
You know, late 15th century. So that was kind of like modern wine poetry. But let's play the Feynman clip. One of my heroes, Richard Feynman, the man who fixed radios by listening to them, and was a master bongo player and
Nobel Prize winner,
and knows more about the quantum mechanics of wine than anybody. Let's play the clip, Matt.
A poet, I think it is, who once said, "The whole universe is in a glass of wine." I don't know. I don't think we'll ever know in what sense he meant that. For the poets don't write to be understood. But it is true that if you look at a glass of wine closely enough, you will see the entire universe. There are the things of physics, the twisting liquid, the reflections in the glass, and our imagination adds the atoms. It evaporates, depending on the wind and weather. The glass is a distillation of the Earth's rocks. And in its composition, as we've seen, the secret of the universe's age and the evolution of the stars. What strange array of chemicals are in the wine? How did they come to be? There are the ferments, the enzymes, the substrates, and the products. And there in wine was found the great generalization. All life is fermentation. Nor can you discover the chemistry of wine without discovering, as did Pasteur, the cause of much disease. How vivid is the claret, pressing its existence into the consciousness that watches it. And if our small minds, for some convenience, divides this glass of wine, this universe, into parts, to physics, biology, geology, astronomy, psychology, and all, remember that nature doesn't know it. So we should put it all back together and not forget at last what it's for. Let it give us one final pleasure more. Drink it up and forget about it all.
Drink it up, Pete. I love that. And I see you're there. You're worried about geometry and theology and philosophy and archaeology. But forget about it all.
Drink it all.
And have a swig.
this is making me so much happier. I was on the verge of, I don't know what to say, but when I got here. It was terrible. But now, this little bit
and
of
now it's magic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like Baudelaire said, right?
I understand in this wine there is truth as well, or so I've been told. In the lingua franca of the Pope, of course.
Yes, in wine there is truth. True.
So we have another bottle to try, right?
We have another bottle
to try. We're going back to Bible times again, are we?
Yeah, this is another Greek wine.
Yeah, here's a little water you can...
on the peninsula.
Have you ever been to Greece, Pete?
To swim the English Channel?
Greece is very sticky.
Greece, yeah. Yes, I've been to Greece many a time. I produced an album in Greece with the top Greek garage rock band. The
top Greek garage band.
Yes. That's our friend
Courtney Adams, Lee Adams Jr.
Courtney, you're very quiet
today. Yeah, yucking it up in the back there.
You're very quiet.
She's refusing to sing.
Well, last drive, and the record was Heat Wave 88. Thank you.
Courtney, let's not forget, made the Shittick, though, and introduced us to Kevin. So thank you for that. If you make three of these Shitticks, you get to go to heaven. That would be...
They're sleepy.
This I was speaking Yiddish, and Matt got confused. But speaking of... Yiddish and Jewish tradition, you know, I love, and we should talk about ancient drunkenness, which doesn't mean like an old dude getting drunk. I'm talking about getting drunk back in ancient times.
We can go to Greenpoint.
I love
for
the part in the Talmud and Purim, of course, is the big Jewish drinking holiday where you are instructed to get so drunk that you can no longer remember your name.
Ah.
So tell us what we're trying now, and will I forget my name?
This is the Limnio wine from Greece, also. You know, a red grape, but a much lighter, more fruity kind of grape than we're used to of Merlot or you know, those kind of grapes.
This seems much more conventional. It looks red in the glass.
The nose is anything but conventional.
Yeah, the nose isn't conventional, but it's not quite as funky.
No, it's got a little, it's like kind of mineral on the nose. It's got some earth, but definitely not as funky. Right. I mean, that other thing was like part of the funkadelic.
It was mineral, like the mothership landed the nose in my with glass. A piece of schist.
Talk about terroir. Do we really want to talk about terroir?
Shall we?
Well, this is very good. This is nice. Yeah. Yes, we shall. Because that's very important.
You know, it's this great sales pitch to say, oh, the minerally taste comes up from the soil, from the limestone, from the flint, and it just completely doesn't.
Right.
But it's a great story.
It's a great story.
Educate and elucidate so it doesn't come up. So
plants don't take mineral. I mean, there's a different kind of mineral, but they don't take flavors up from the soil.
But
it does affect how they grow.
Exactly.
And the productivity of the vine and the happiness of the vine.
But the grapes that are grown differently, like Cabernet, which I believe is the most popular grape in the world, grows everywhere, but a Cabernet from California tastes different than an Old World Cabernet, which is sort of at the heart of Bordeaux, which tastes different from some of the South American Cabernets.
But you know what the horrible secret is that nobody wants to say? The yeast contributes some of the minerality flavors. It's
like
the bass player in the rock band who gets none of the fame and fortune.
Exactly.
But he's super important. The yeast actually contributes some
of the foundation.
Oh, come now. You couldn't name more than two bass players who are actually important.
they're the foundation. That's all I can know.
But it's not such a great sales pitch to say the yeast are giving you that irony, minerally flavor. You know, they'd rather say it comes up from the soil. But
I've been told by someone in the know, he says, listen, all bottles of wine, no bottle of wine costs more than $5 to produce. Okay, it's a bunch of grapes, and that's it. After that, you're paying for marketing. You might be paying
the land.
And the real estate. Yeah, the real estate. And you know, obviously, if it says Rothschild on it, you get a bump. That's the marketing. And the land has been there for a while. But basically, you're talking about a bottle of grape juice. And also, the myth of the wine... and the perceived scarcity of wine when it's actually quite often a mass-produced product. But the idea is to make one case less than you think you can sell to create the, you know...
And to get the Chinese interested in
the illusion of scarcity.
In China, we
funny
did...
Funny you mentioned that.
In China, we did get to drink some interesting wine.
You know, they were making... It turns out they were making wine even 9 or 10,000 years ago, but it was like a rice wine with kind of a different jasmine kind of grape. They had the same rituals, just different type of wine.
Yeah. Well, I think people make booze from what they find where they live, right? Isn't that the story of bourbon?
Right? Yeah, date palm wine. There's African wine from all sorts of things.
Cola wine.
Yep, there's wine in Central America.
That's the story of bourbon, though. When they got here and they found out that corn was what grew here, that's what they made the liquor out of.
That's exactly, and they made a lot of it. And they also realized that it was easy to transport as a export item.
And I was very happy that they did. Me and Jerry Lee Lewis were very pleased with the bourbon.
You know, when we were the Fleshtones, of course, are always studying my band as we travel.
Studying the Bible? Yes, every night.
But we also study the drinking habits of the local areas that we visit. And one thing that we kept contributing
to the per capita consumption.
Oh, totally. We contribute to it everywhere we go. But when we were visiting Ravenna and the beautiful so-called sepulchre of Galla Placida, and one of the masterpiece of mosaics of late Roman art, and the word was that her favorite wine was the Albani, but then people wonder, was this just a little bit of PR put into effect by a 13th century writer who trying to boost the Albani thing? But we don't know.
They named a lot of particular vineyards and regions, Falernian, Albani, so it looks like they definitely had their preferences. Right. We don't know if that was the grape name, though, or just the vineyard region name. But definitely.
Yeah, because of this now in the Ravenna area, though, they are upgrading the Albani. Well, they're putting quality production into the Albani. It's quite nice, actually. It's a wonderful wine if you pay some attention to it, like any other, I guess. I don't know.
I got to tell you, I quite like what we're drinking now. It's opening up again. Tell us about it again.
You know, that's the big... I was a really normal, average wine drinker 10 years ago. I drank Chardonnay, Merlot, this, that, Riesling. And I didn't realize there were hundreds and hundreds of native local grapes all over the world, just like you said, if you take care of making it. And even some of the top wine experts, like scientists, are coming to say the same thing. It's all just a marketing scam to say it's only 5 or 6 grapes.
Well, there's a bit in your book where Eric Asimov says, I can't believe I'm falling for a wine from Vermont.
Made from hybrid grapes with American wild grape DNA.
Because the Vermont terroir is not generally indicative of good wine producing, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's terrific, but they have a great winemaker there, Deirdre Heekin, and she planted these American hybrid grapes that are doing great. You would never guess it was an American wine. You'd think it was from northern Italy.
Right. Well, I think this Greek wine is definitely turning the key.
Give a shout-out to the bass player in Hudson.
Fred
Smith.
Yeah.
Oh, Fred Smith, that's right.
You see, now there's a bass player that matters because he makes
about 2 years.
Wine. I just tried his wine for the first time a couple of days ago.
I think it's excellent.
Sergina Smith Winery.
That's right. They still doing the Rock and Roll Red? Is that still the label?
Yep. And Eaten by Bears. I recommend the Eaten by Bears.
Eaten by Bears.
Oh, come on, Courtney. When are you going to get Fred on the show?
Eaten by
Bears. Let's get Fred and his beautiful wife down here talk about wine and maybe
Fred, that's right.
And play the bass.
And his adventures with the Fleshtones in Spain.
Exactly.
I didn't realize that. That was sort of like
he came staggering out of the mist.
Fred Smith, currently of television.
They did. It's a staggering. We were on a long drive on a mountain pass. We had to stop. We were above the clouds. It was misting. We stopped to pee because we had been drinking. And Fred Smith.
Which didn't stop them from driving up a mountain.
Fred Smith came staggering out of the mist, looked into my eyes with mock terror, and said, "Now I know. Zaremba is Alucard spelled backwards."
There was nothing mock about that.
Son of Dracula, right? Lon Chaney Jr., right? You get the reference?
No.
Dracula.
It's the big reveal in Lon Chaney Jr.'s Son of Dracula, where the hero says, he's posing as Count Alucard, and finally towards the end of the movie, the hero says, "Alucard is Dracula spelled backwards."
And of course, my favorite line from the Bela Lugosi Dracula, yours too: "I do not drink wine."
True.
All right. As always, it's been the fastest half hour on the internet today. Yeah, we gotta go, Pete. We're gonna drink some of this Greek wine. We're getting some pizza. But before we go, I think there's going to be a little bit more song one more time. Let's hear it for Kevin Bigos and his fantastic new book, Tasting the Past. The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. You will recognize it by the DNA strand on the cover. Good to see you, Kevin.
Thank you, Mike.
I wish that you come by. Back again, because this wine. Is we barely scratched the surface.
We didn't even read a single wine. Well, we read one wine poem.
And we're singing some songs, and we heard Richard Feynman, and we're drinking this Greek wine.
Larry's brother.
And we're gonna have some pizza now. And I think this is gonna pair very well.
What are we doing? We're gonna let the guitars roll. Is that what we're gonna do?
Yeah, I think we should.
Okay, give me
bon ton roulette.
Give me the key to it. Yeah, let's hit the bon ton roulette.
All right, okay.
Which means nothing in French.
Yeah, I don't even know how this starts. Hey, why don't you start it?
Hey, everybody, let's have some fun. You only live but once, and when you're dead, you're done. So let the good times roll. Let the good times roll. Yeah, baby. Don't care if you're young and old. Get together. Let the good times roll. Now let me tell you something. Don't sit there mumbling and talking trash. If you want to have a ball, you got to spend some cash. And let the good times roll. Let the good times roll. Don't care if you're young and old. Get together, let the good times roll. Counting Shark is in town. We got $5 and a quarter, and we're ready to clown. But don't let nobody play us cheap. We got $4 more than we're gonna keep. Let the good times roll. Let the good times roll.
Hearts and seizures, can you dig it?
I want more of that wine.
All right. Woo! Episode number 243, we're counting down to 250. See you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.